Well, our second speaker this morning is Danny Kleinfelter. He is a professor and extension economist with Texas AgriLife Extension and Texas A&M University. Additionally, Danny is the director of the Executive Program for Agricultural Producers, co-director of the Texas A&M Family and Owner-Managed Business Program, and serves as executive secretary for the Association of Agricultural Production Executives. I'm not sure where he finds the time, but Dr. Kleinfelter also serves as a member of the board of Ag Texas Farm Credit Services and president of his family's Illinois Farm Corporation. Danny has authored or co-authored 8 books and over 400 articles on management and finance. In addition to his long and very distinguished academic career, Dr. Kleinfelter spent 10 years in commercial banking and the farm credit system. In 2009, the 25th anniversary issue of the Top Producer magazine listed him as one of the 25 people in the world who will have the greatest influence on the future of American agriculture. And the following year, Danny received the American Agricultural Editors Association's Distinguished Service to Agriculture Award. We are honored to have Dr. Danny Kleinfelter speak to us this morning about cash flow planning and analysis during times of drought. Danny, welcome, and the mic is all yours.
All right. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to start with a couple of things. Let me just go ahead and move to the second page. Is the first two sheets of what I have for an extension economist are going to be very redundant. But what I found is when I deal with producers, before I go into any financial statement, I talk about what are the uses of that statement. You're not just doing it as a requirement for somebody. It has value. So let me run over those quickly. The one thing about the cash flow or the cash flow budget is it provides the best measure of operational liquidity as opposed to structural liquidity on the balance sheet. It's the ability to meet financial obligations as they become due without disrupting the ongoing continuing operation of the business. The second, as a projected tool, the statement helps formalize the overall planning process. By that, I mean it gets it down on paper. Third, it can assist in evaluating borrowing needs and repayment plans. When are you going to need the money? How much? And when can you pay it back? Fourth, it serves as a financial control tool. By the monitoring through the year of the actual performance versus what was budgeted and looking at the variances, it allows the farmer to know whether he needs to change the plan, alter it, or take action instead of waiting until too much time has passed. Fifth, it formalizes the process of integrating the budgets and plans for the various enterprises of the business. Many businesses are composed of many enterprises, not just commodities, but in some cases related businesses. At some point, you have to pull it all together to look at how it works. Sixth, directs attention to the management of cash reserves. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's not a big issue, but it definitely has been in the corn and soybean country. How much do you have at surplus at times? How long are you likely to have it? What are your options to temporarily use that cash to maximize the return to the business? Fifth, if you put together different what-if scenarios or projections for different alternatives, it's a very practical tool from my standpoint of analyzing or the impact of risk or uncertainty on the business. Fifth, it really helps assess the relationship among your production, marketing, and financial plans. Instead of just treating them as separately, any top manager has to look at that as an integrated whole. We in academia sometimes teach our specialty area, but that farmer's got to put it all together. Ninth, by comparing projected cash flows under current operations and then under modified operations, it can serve as an investment analysis tool. Basically, you know, what kind of debts are going to take on, what kind of repayment requirements, additional expenses, additional and timing of revenue, if we take this on as opposed to the current situation, helps you analyze the feasibility of investments. The last one isn't what it can do, it's what it can't do. The cash flow, even though farmers are on cash accounting for tax purposes, is not a good measure of profitability. Accrual adjuster, true accrual accounting is the only thing that can really reflect profitability. Cash accounting can typically lead to 2 or 3 year lags in recognizing profitability problems. The thing that bothers a lot of farmers is their cash flowing and not sure what the lender's so concerned about. The reality is a farm can be going broke and cash flowing just the same as it can be profitable and unable to cash flow. There's a lot of reasons for that, and we could go into it if anybody wants to talk about that later. All right, let's turn to the third slide. Well, my arrow will click. Here's what I think the biggest problem is. The biggest problem for most producers is budgeting accuracy. There was one study, and it was within Farm Credit, so it hasn't been published as an academic journal, that looked at over 300 farm borrowers over a four-year period of time. And on average, this 300 overestimated their cash receipts by 15% and underestimated their cash expenditures by 17%. The thing you got to realize, that's not a 32% error. As a percent of the estimated net cash flow, that was over a 300% error. And it's real hard to run a business if you're that far off. The point is, if errors were purely a function of price and quantity variability, then receipts should have been underestimated as often as they were overestimated. Same is true of expenditures, underestimated as often as overestimated. What it shows here, when there's a consistent bias upward on revenue, downward on expenditures, that either the projections were based on too much wishful thinking or optimism, there wasn't enough good information to actually prepare the statement, or there was a deliberate attempt on the part of the preparer to present the best case scenario as, in fact, as if it were the most likely. Now, we all know borrowers, and that'd be true of me as well, are going to be inclined to cast the best light on the situation if I'm providing it to my lender. But one thing they don't need to be doing is basically kidding themselves. Okay, well, I'm getting this a little slow here. The typical producers I've found, at least in my extension meetings, treat financial planning analysis, particularly cash flow, as a beginning and end of the year exercise. They do one, a projected for their lender. The other, at the end of the year, they summarize their cash information for tax purposes. But even then, for the most part, the typical producer sees this as more of a chore than it is an opportunity. The most successful managers, on the other hand, spend a lot of time on planning, monitoring, and analyzing performance. And by staying on top of how things are going, they're much more likely to be prepared for those things that could and do happen, to spot problems early enough on and opportunities early enough on that they can fix them or take advantage of them before it's too late. Now we're looking at drought, not just drought, but any time of stress. My point is that it becomes even more important that producers put a lot of emphasis on cash flow planning and analysis in those periods. I'm going to look at three best practices that I see a lot of the top 1% of producers in this country employing. Now, I know there's the 99 versus a 1%, but the top 1% of producers in this country produce nearly 40% of our output. So it's the larger, not just huge, but larger commercial operations I'm talking about. The first one, they look at what-if scenarios, sensitivity analysis, and contingency planning. Essentially, what we're doing here is they consider what could happen, whether it's good or bad, and I'd underline that and what they would do if it did. They don't limit themselves to these most likely best case and worst case scenarios, which is about as far as we typically could go in advising farmers and looking at more just than what you expect to happen. But they use their judgment, the historical records and experience they have, as well as the current outlook that Extension or USDA are providing in order to make those estimates. The other thing is they don't limit themselves to the last few years. One of the things I hear all the time, I've heard it in the grain business lately and others, is this concept, it's a new paradigm. These guys take that with a real heavy dose of salt. They tend to be less caught up by that in the irrational exuberance that everybody jump on board going up, and the irrational fear, the rats fleeing a sinking ship on the downside. They're looking over time. Third thing is they take both a long-term view of planning when considering scenarios. I know right now, and most producers are just worried about next year. These guys are taking short-term, but as well as long-term. I'm going to cover just a few of these. For example, in the long-term, they look at the four D's that family businesses talk about. Death, divorce, disability, departure. Basically, what would we do if that happened? You know, what's our succession plan? Do we have a buy-sell agreement in place between the ownership parties in order to deal with it? We've obviously got a lot of things like drought, disease output we have to look at. But more immediate things, the idea of what if output prices, what if land prices or yields fell by 50% next year? They did that a lot of places this year. Equally, what if input prices were to double? Those sort of things are what I'm looking at in terms of evaluating these what-if scenarios. One of the things I've found is if you're looking at, and I'll take corn and soybeans, you can tell I originally come from Illinois. But we tend to look at things in 10-bushel yield increments, like 100, 110, 130, and look at prices on a 50-cent price moves. I mean, in our, if we've got a 200-bushel base and we've got a 50% price move, we're talking about $100 an acre. I mean, that's more, it's not so granulated that it's, this is just ultimately time-consuming, but it's a lot more time-consuming that a lot of producers put into it. The second thing is they evaluate and consider all possible risk mitigation options, not just what they typically done. If they see something new coming aboard, they evaluate it. That, you know, whether this is insurance, revenue or margin insurance, just straight crop insurance, looking at options, puts and calls, pre-purchasing, contract, developing contracts if you're a contract supplier or buyer with modifications within it, or the idea of trying to move to flex leases from cash rents. Those are all, as well as other things we see, things that they try to pursue or look at. Okay, third, the second is we're looking at regular monitoring and analysis between projected and actual cash flows, down to individual line items. Now, this may be monthly or quarterly evaluations, depending on the nature of the business. But if unusual circumstances arise, it's going to happen more often. What they're trying to do is the following. The first is to identify base or biases. Is there an area we consistently are overly optimistic or overly pessimistic? You see that a lot. What you realize is your opinion is biased in some way. You need to figure out why and adjust for that. And also your major areas of risk or otherwise major areas of variability. Which line items or areas within the business are having the greatest volatility over time? That's where you need to focus your risk management efforts. What it does is allow them to be better able to capitalize on opportunities and correct problems, as well as adjusting future plans if things are changing. You know, it's like heart problems or cancer, anything of that nature. If you're getting blood pressure increasing, a cholesterol buildup, then you need to do something about it. A cancer, if it's trapped or captured in its before it metastasizes, is very treatable. Same with heart. If the damage has already been done before the heart, the cancer metastasizes, the heart attack occurs, even if the person or the business survives, it can't be as strong as it was before. One of the things these guys realize, and most of you have probably seen this yourself, is the biggest difference they found between the top 10% of producers and the rest of the top 25%, I don't mean the top 25 versus the bottom, is largely timing. When they buy, when they sell, when they enter a new area, when they expand, when they cut back, when they reallocate. A lot of the staying on top of it is to improve their timing. It's obvious and it's pretty easy to see when you look at commodity market moves, weather changes, other stock markets even. But this applies to all areas of the business. The other thing about a really top producer or a very business-oriented one is every item in that spreadsheet or whatever they're using to develop their budget projections is every item is tied to a set of assumptions. What that does is if there are differences in that number than what they projected, it makes it easier for them to drill down to causes and not be focusing so much on symptoms. That's a problem our government has. That's a problem voters, general population, and the media have. They're real symptom-oriented. That isn't the way to fix things. F on here is monitoring isn't just limited to what happened, what has happened. I mean, if you're looking at projected versus actual cash flows, one of the things you have to look at the time is not just whether there's a variance now, but at the time you're doing that assessment, look at, have the external environment, expectations change to let you know, should we in fact adjust our budget going forward? It's like a coach making halftime adjustments if he's playing football. Okay, turn to the last one of these are autopsies. This is one I think is extremely important. This is one that use the least of all of these. It's basically conducting debriefings on the results of key decisions, whether things went well or badly, after the fact. Like the Blue Angel performance pilot team, every performance they sit down and have a debriefing. When you've got two planes coming at each other, $30 million aircraft at several hundred miles an hour, they can't afford mistakes. And so these sessions get honest and brutal. I mean, otherwise you're going to have $60 million in molten steel. You're going to have two dead pilots and the possibility of harming and even killing a great deal of spectators. We used to do the same thing with loan officers and sitting down on loans that had problems and went bad or caused a loss. What happened here? What did we learn from it so that you don't do the same thing over? All right. When we're looking at this, why things turned out the way they did, and that's the purpose of this. I'll just hit several points. What you're trying to do is decide, what did we overlook? What assumptions at the beginning of the year did we make that were wrong? What could we have done after the fact differently? Hindsight's always 20/20. Were there mid-course adjustments we should have made and even could have? Are there any risk mitigation tools, or could we have done contingency planning to help us deal with this situation? Are there either any leading indicators or better information that would help us in the future? You know, if we'd have known about the weather conditions developing in Brazil or an economic problem in China, whether what's happening in Europe, other sorts of things, Iran, those can play a big deal. And what's going to happen, oil, other price movements. Okay. The other point here, just think about this, because this happens, you listen to this in the coffee shop talk. If they bought low or sold high, the question is, were they just lucky, or did they have a marketing plan or decision plan and process that they can repeat or use again? More in the opposite. They sold low, bought high. The issue is, looking back on it, were there opportunities that they missed? More important, and the reason for doing all this, is what do we learn? And what are we going to do differently in the future? Are we going to repeat things because we found we have something that works? Or does this mean we really need to change? The old saying by Einstein, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Another thing about these autopsies that I think helps a lot in family farms, family businesses, they're a great team communication and learning tool. You have the management team and the key members of the group sitting down together talking about this. Everybody learns something. The other, it's really important for successor development. The son, the daughter, whatever that's coming up. Being involved in these situations going along really brings them in and helps them grow as a decision maker based on somebody else's experience as well as their own. It's really important to keep notes and written minutes to develop action plans and assign responsibilities and timetables on these things. Because as you all know, procrastination is very real and memories are very short and selective. What happened? You ask them what their assumptions were before the year and what I, unless they wrote it down in their cash flow plan. It's a great deal of difference. If you've ever been in court, you'll find witnesses have incredible differences as to what they saw. I'm going to close with this one. Just a couple of quotes. I think we all need to remember everybody, including us, exists in four states of knowledge. Well, you know what you do know. Well, you know what you don't know. That's not so bad. If you know what you don't know, you can work on figuring it out. The dangerous ones are the last two. What you don't know, you don't know. There are a lot of things out there. You're just unaware that you're unaware. This is ignorance, not stupidity. The last one is where you think you know something and it just isn't true. Those are the two areas. This is why I'm real big on pushing these peer advisory groups and these debriefing meetings. I think we can learn from each other. The last one I'm going to point out is Douglas Adams was a quote in a book called The Breakthrough Company. It's kind of the small business version of Good to Great. Human beings, he said, who are almost unique in their ability to learn from the experiences of others, are also remarkable for their disinclination to do so. Okay, that's how I'm going to wrap up. In terms of this entire webinar, I'm the only one not talking about taxes, but I think this part of it, both now and more importantly under stress, but going forward, is going to be extremely important.
Well, thank you, Danny. You did a great job of explaining the value in cash flow planning and analysis, especially during extreme weather conditions. And I agree with the need for and the ever-growing importance of cash flows. A couple of questions for you, or a few questions. You know, drought is a kind of a creeping disaster as opposed to a single event. At what point should a producer begin conversation with his or her lender, partners, others, when conditions are causing major changes to be made?
Sooner the better. The lenders see this happening too. And I think both at the time you apply, even if drought hasn't come about, you know, last year with cornbread, where we thought we were going to have record yields and other things, I think the fact the person demonstrates they've thought about it and what they, if there's any risk mitigation tools and what they would do if it does happen, tells a lender an awful lot about their management ability and the way they think. Then as you go along, the first time you recognize it's starting to happen, even if you don't think it's severe as it's going to be, or it might correct itself, which it could. But they still think it's useful to go in and see your lender and sit down and talk to him.
Okay, good. In your studies and experiences, have you noticed any differences such as age, gender, enterprise mix, mindset, anything else between the most successful producers and the less successful producers in terms of cash flow budgeting and analysis?
I wouldn't say it's chronological age. I think it's middle age. I've seen some, you know, 60-some-year-old guys that are just incredibly progressive. Look at in our academic site, Peter, for his management mind, was 95 and was thinking ahead of people 30-some. I mean, there's 70-year-olds trapped in 30-year-old bodies, and there's vice versa. But I don't think it's an age thing. I think it's an attitude thing.
Okay, good. One final question, and it's actually a two-part question. From a lender's perspective, and maybe it's from a producer's perspective as well, are there some better ways to encourage rather than simply requiring a farmer or rancher to develop and monitor a cash flow for management purposes? And then,
obviously, Oh, go ahead. Sorry, two parts.
The second part of that is, what are your thoughts about a producer or business owner, manager, developing a statement of cash flows for the lender and for one for himself?
Two separate ones, kind of the good, looking as good as it can for the lender, and then being willing to tell yourself the truth. If that's what it takes, if you particular, a really good lender and you're a good manager should be willing to look at the fact that you've considered those different options. You have some lenders that the best thing you can do is kind of present a situation that's pretty positive. If you've ever told them something, you know, we've looked at this option, and they put it in file, and a bank examiner comes along and uses that against them, then you've got some issues. But
right.
In terms of incentivizing people, there are some lenders. Back when Tom Fry and I put together coordinated financial statements, and that's where some of you guys were born, we had lenders doing training sessions and then offering borrowers who brought in complete statement, cash or accrual, monitored cash flows and other things, that would give them, incentivize them to provide to produce lower interest rates, either up front or in effect at the end of the year have a rebate, an interest rebate. You know, if you met all of these requirements, we'll recalculate your interest or give you a discount starting toward next year. And this, that could always be, it's easier there, less next year. This is our going rate. Now, people are always going to say, yeah, well, you say that, but this is, but most, you know, a lender could, he couldn't say who, but he could say, I'm charging farmers rates that range right now, let's say on operating money, from 9 to 5%. And most of that is my cost of doing business with them and the risk in the loan.
Sure.
And if you can make a difference on this, I'm going to share that with you because you cut my risk and you cut the lender or my regulatory pressure.
Good, good, good. Well, Danny, we really appreciate your comments and your willingness to ask questions. We look forward to hearing more from you in the future, and I think some of us will actually be going to some of your website information looking for some of these multiple fact sheets that you've written. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.